Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. We're going to start today with an article from AARP, the magazine, that we've been going through, and it's entitled Eyewitnessed History. Today, we're going to start with the horror of Kent State. Dean R. Coller, 72, retired civil servant and school teacher, on surviving the shootings that changed America. I started at Kent State University in the spring of 1970 at 20 years old. I had never been to an anti-war demonstration myself because if you worked on a farm or in a steel mill, as I had, there was no time for such things. I was the son of a World War II veteran, and I was involved in my church. On the night of April 30th, I was in a pub in the town of Kent, listening to President Nixon's speech. When the president announced that U.S. troops would be invading Cambodia, the pub erupted in boos. It seemed like this was going to be an expansion of the war instead of a reduction. Students were angry, me included. I went home for the weekend, and while I was gone, protesters burned an ROTC building. When I returned to campus Sunday evening, the place was like an armed camp. National Guard troops were everywhere. It was shocking, because this was rural Ohio, not exactly a hotbed of liberal thinking. The next day, May 4th, I figured I would go to the protest that was to start at noon. There were 2,000 or 3,000 people gathered, shouting anti-war chants. The National Guard troops were there, putting on their gas masks and helmets. At one point, some troops came out in a jeep with a campus police officer holding a bullhorn. If we didn't disperse, he said, the National Guard would disperse us. That didn't go over well. So the National Guard troops got into formation and began firing tear gas. There was chaos. I ended up in a gravel parking lot wiping tear gas out of my eyes and nose. I remained about 100 yards from the troops. I watched as they formed two lines with their rifles and bayonets forward. They began to march toward a crowd of students who cleared a path for them. The troops reached the top of a hill. I was at the bottom. They turned in unison and aimed their weapons down the hill. I thought, my God, they're going to shoot. I jumped down and covered my head, and all of a sudden I heard bullets hitting the ground around me, making this zoop sound. Then I felt something like a bee sting in my back, and I felt my legs tighten up, then relax. When the shooting stopped, there was this awful silence. Then people started seeing the bodies and the chaos resumed. Four young people were killed by National Guard troops, and many more lay heavily injured. I ended up at Robinson Memorial Hospital, still conscious. They put me in an induced coma after surgery. When I awoke days later and learned of my fate, I was angry. But when the doctors told me what they had told my parents, I felt truly thankful to be alive. They told my parents to pray for me to survive 1 hour, and if I did, then to pray that I would survive 2 hours. And if I made it 12 hours, I would probably survive. I have lived 52 years as a paraplegic. I have had a rewarding career, and I am a wheelchair runner currently training for my third marathon. I still feel today the way I did when I woke in the hospital, thankful to be alive. Next we have I've Seen the Promised Land, the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. on the eve of his death. Clara Jean Esther, 74, a community organizer, on the last moments of Martin Luther King Jr.'s life. The church was packed. There were people standing in the aisles of the Mason Temple. Martin Luther King Jr. was in Memphis, but there was a tornado watch, and he had been advised to stay at the Lorraine Motel. Ralph Abernathy would do the talking this night. There were so many people. Somebody called Dr. King and said, "The people didn't come to hear Ralph. They came to hear you. You need to get dressed and come down here." I was a junior at Le Moyne College in Memphis and very engaged in the movement. There was a sanitation strike going on, and Dr. King had come to lead a nonviolent protest in support of the workers. When he came to the Mason Temple that night to speak, April 3, 1968, I was there. No one could know that this was the last speech he would ever make. He started to talk about his life story. In retrospect, it was like he was giving his own eulogy. He said he knew there had been threats on his life, but that didn't matter. "Because I've been to the mountaintop," he said, "and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we, as a people, will get to the promised land." The feeling in the church when he said these words was indescribable. The next day, Dr. King had catfish for lunch at the Lorraine Motel, and fellow organizer James Orange said that this catfish was so good he wanted to treat everyone. I was at the Claiborne Temple, and I got in my car to drive to the Lorraine Motel with my car full of people. When we got there, we headed for the lobby entrance. Dr. King came out of his room, just above us on a balcony, and I could see him talking to some people and smiling. Someone told him to go back and get a coat because it was going to get a little cooler at night. He turned, but Ralph Abernathy stopped him and said he would get the coat. Suddenly, I heard what sounded like a truck backfiring and people saying, "Get down, get down." I took off up the stairs. Dr. King was flat on his back. I tried to grab his wrist to take his pulse. I was on the side where the wound was. He was losing a lot of blood. I could see his chest rising, so I thought, "That's a good sign. He's still alive." His eyes were open and looking upward. All I could think about was his speech from the night before when he said, "I may not get there with you." Soon police officers arrived and the ambulance got there with the stretcher. The police wouldn't let us leave, and as we were waiting there, it came on the news that Dr. King was dead. I didn't talk about it for a long time. I never went back to the Lorraine Motel until it became a museum. I picked up my life and kept on going. Every year I celebrate Martin Luther King Jr. on his birthday because he was a gift from God. Every April 4th I mourn because that gift was taken away. And I'm going to do one more because we can use some good news here. The Giants win the pennant. George Hirsch, 87, founding publisher of New York Magazine and chairman of New York Roadrunners, on baseball's greatest home run. On October 3, 1951, my friends and I were sitting in our homeroom class at New Rochelle High School, north of New York City, bored and frustrated 17-year-olds. That afternoon, at the Polo Grounds in Manhattan, the Brooklyn Dodgers were taking on the New York Giants in a game that would decide the National League pennant. You could not overstate how important baseball was at that time in American culture, or how important it was to us. My buddies and I had a brainstorm. "What are we doing here in class? Let's hit the road." We snuck out of school and headed for the Polo Grounds. New York was the center of the baseball universe. All season long, the Dodgers had held a commanding lead in the standings over the Giants, but the Giants salvaged their season with a 16-game winning streak. Incredibly, the regular season ended in a dead tie. I was a Dodgers fan, and these players were my heroes: Jackie Robinson, Duke Snider, Gil Hodges, Carl Furillo. We stood in line 2 hours for our tickets and paid $2 apiece. The game was so close, all 34,000-plus fans held their breath through every pitch. But in the eighth inning, Sal Magley, the Giants pitcher, weakened, allowing the Dodgers to take a 4-1 lead. I'll admit, I celebrated too early. In the bottom of the ninth, the Giants scored a run and had two men on base when Bobby Thompson came to bat. On deck stood Willie Mays, the 20-year-old rookie for whom I would later name my son. The Dodgers summoned Ralph Branca from the bullpen to replace the starter, Don Newcomb. Branca's first pitch was a fastball down the middle. Thompson didn't move. The time was 3:58 p.m. In his novel, Underworld, Don DeLillo describes Branca's next pitch. Not a good pitch to hit. Up and in. But Thompson swings and tomahawks the ball, and everybody watches. All I can remember was the pure shock of it, recalls my friend Steve Goddard, sitting next to me at that moment, and then I was crying. My friend Buster Grossman, also sitting next to me, along with our buddy Greg Dillon, recalls hearing the now famous refrain from a nearby radio from the announcer Russ Hodges. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. The Giants win the pennant. We watched in awe as Thompson circled the bases, jumping up and down. I left the Polo Grounds that day feeling like I had been struck by lightning, and Bobby Thompson's home run was since become known as the shot heard round the world. Today, over 70 years later, I'm still friends with the three guys I went to see that game with. My late wife, Shay, gave me a photo autographed by Thompson and the pitcher Branca, which hangs in my office. I remember that night when I got home after the game. Someday, my father told me, you'll get over it. Maybe someday I will. Now, looking at AARP The Bulletin, your money, financially speaking, low interest rates, Social Security, home sales, and more. And we have a picture here with a quotation. It says, I love your questions, but there is one that I have been grappling with myself. When is the right time to retire? Well, maybe we'll find out in a minute. AARP Bulletin's personal finance columnist answers your questions and shares some retirement news. Your emails about money-related issues have been piling up in my mailbox, so I'm devoting this whole column to answering them. Read all the way to the end for another note from me, and that was from Linda. I'm a retired 72-year-old with $100,000 in savings in a money market account, earning a paltry 0.5%. I lost much of my nest egg in the 2008-09 crash, and stocks seem to be crashing again now. How can I invest my money so that the risks are low and I can beat inflation and maybe even earn a little extra income? Well, somewhere you might find a free lunch, but nowhere will you find a risk-free investment that beats inflation and pays extra income. A better strategy would be to figure out a way to take advantage of the stock market's ability to generate big returns over time. That means developing a plan and sticking to it, says Minneapolis financial advisor Ross Levin, who worries that otherwise you'll do what you did the last go-round, that is, ditch stocks when the market is down. Parentheses, as I write this, stocks are down 14% for the year. The proven plan, gradually put money into a low-cost broad market stock indexed fund, adds more money every month. Don't cut and run as things go south. And because you are pretty nervous about this, just devote a small percentage of your money to stocks, say 30%. You can eke out a bit more return from the rest of your money by buying bonds, including Series 1 bonds, or Treasury Inflation Protection Securities, TIPS, T-I-P-S. But beware, as interest rates rise, you can lose money in fixed-rate investments. Money market funds and online savings accounts tend to raise their yields as short-term interest rates rise. So you'll be happy if you keep some of your cash there. Question. As a retiree with accessible funds, watching the inflation rate rise, I am thinking of purchasing some I-bonds. Any advice? Savings bonds, generally called I-bonds, are U.S. Treasury bonds that are designed to protect against inflation by paying interest pegged to the Consumer Price Index. Their annual interest rate, adjusted every 6 months, is currently 9.62%. Any bond you buy from now through October will carry that rate for half a year, when it will adjust up or down based on inflation at the time. An annual 9.62 percentage rate is wonderful for ultra-safe government-backed money, and so investing in them now is smart. But keep this in mind. 1. If the inflation rate falls, so will your interest rate. 2. You don't get the interest rate until you cash in the bonds, and if you do that in the first 5 years of owning them, you'll forfeit 3 months of interest as a penalty. 3. You're limited to buying $10,000 worth of bonds per calendar year, or $15,000, but only by using a federal tax refund for the amount beyond $10,000, and making the purchase when you file your return. Now back to AARP the magazine, and let's look at some real people. Inspiring stories of friends and neighbors in their own world, in their own words. And there's a picture here of somebody on the site of the future Wallace Annenberg Wildlife Crossing with a life-size cutout of P-22, a big cat. She has a big smile, and you can see the traffic behind her. Wildlife protector, safe crossing for cats. The way Beth Pratt became the de facto BFF of the Hollywood Cougar. Most people are never going to see a mountain lion up close. They've nicknamed ghost cats because they stay secretive. But they're around. P-22 is a very famous mountain lion that lives in Los Angeles. I call him the Brad Pitt of the cougar world. He's handsome. He has aged well. He's very comfortable chilling under the Hollywood sign. This cat is why I got involved in creating a bridge for wildlife over the 101 freeway. The P in his name stands for Puma, and he's the 22nd one tagged in a National Park Service study. But he's the only one living in Griffith Park. He's separated from the rest of the local cougars, a group of about 10 to 15, by roads and freeways. No one is sure how he survived crossing two of the busiest highways in the country to find a home. In 2012, I was told that because of highway fragmenting habitat and the cougar's shrinking gene pool, scientists feared the local ones might go extinct. I thought, not on my watch. I just felt that this was a problem we could solve. By building a 175-foot-wide vegetated bridge over the highway, we could safely connect the cougar's habitat. I got the organization I work for, the National Wildlife Federation, to join the other project partners, such as the National Park Service and the Santa Monica Mountains Conservancy. Later, the Annenberg Foundation got involved along with a lot of individual donors. Finally, on Earth Day of this year, we broke ground. We expect the crossing to be completed by 2025, and I can't wait to see the first animal use it. I don't want anyone to fear wildlife. The wild world is marvelous. It gives me joy and awe, and I wonder and wonder. I want that for everyone. And this was as told to Leslie Quander Wooldridge. Beth Pratt, 53, is the California Regional Director for the National Wildlife Federation. She splits her time between Los Angeles and her home near Yosemite National Park. Now let's look at one more of these feel-good stories, The Accidental Advocate. Cookbook author Grace Young stepped out of character to help save a neighborhood. My father was a very big part of the Chinatown community in San Francisco. He was a liquor salesman and he knew every restaurant owner there. We couldn't walk more than 20 steps on the street without someone calling out his name. So San Francisco's Chinatown always felt like home to me. The one in New York City was different. Even though I've lived in New York for 40 years and would go to Chinatown regularly to shop, I never made an effort to get to know the people who lived and worked there. I'm a little shy. The neighborhood was so busy, the sidewalks were so crowded, that I would have to weave my way through to find ingredients for the recipes I had developed. That all changed in January of 2020. Suddenly, all the stores were empty. People were afraid to come to Chinatown just because the COVID-19 virus had originated in China. When I saw the neighborhood as a ghost town, it made me think about what we would lose if it were gone. The story of Chinatown, like those of other traditional immigrant neighborhoods, is an American story. So many of these entrepreneurs had come to this country with nothing, and through sheer grit and hard work, had realized the American dream. I think the place should be designated as a living national treasure. With videographer Dan On, I began what became an 11-part video series called Coronavirus Chinatown Stories to bring attention to the struggles of New York's Chinatown and other Chinese communities. Then I began to stumble upon other ways to help. When hate-motivated attacks on Asian Americans started to rise, I worked with a group called Asian Americans for Equality to distribute personal security devices in Chinatown. With the community organization Welcome to Chinatown, I raised money to buy meals from Chinatown's legacy restaurants and deliver them to older people and those in need. Last October, I partnered with the James Beard Foundation and Poster House Museum to launch the social media campaign #LoveAAPI to support Asian American and Pacific Islander small businesses, which are still the target of hate crimes. There have been many days when I've felt down, but recently a friend sent me this quote, "Action is the antidote to despair," and I thought, yes. The work I've done for Chinatown has actually given me focus and purpose over the last 2 years. Maybe the biggest lesson I've learned from this is that there are no magical heroes waiting in the wings. If we don't help each other, nothing will happen. But if everyone does what they can, it really does make a difference. And this article was as told to Andrea Adelman. Cookbook author Grace Young, 66, who is known as the stir-fry guru, is the James Beard Foundation's Humanitarian of the Year. She will receive the 2022 Julia Child Award in October this month. It looks like we have time for the last I've Witnessed History article in this magazine, and this was entitled, "This is the big one." Gary Siganaka, 68, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Emeritus Scientist on the Exxon Valdez spill. On March 24, 1989, I was working in the offices of NOAA in Seattle when I heard a commotion down the hall. People from our hazardous materials response branch were scrambling, and I heard the head of the team say, "This is the big one." That's when I learned that the supertanker Exxon Valdez had run aground off the coast of Alaska. The hazmat team was dispatched as the first responders, and my scientific research group quickly followed. The federal government is not known for getting things done quickly, but in an amazing short time, NOAA took an old mothballed hydrographic survey ship called the Fairweather, which was outfitted to gather information for nautical charts, and turned it into a scientific research vessel. In May, I flew from Seattle to meet the ship in Cordova, Alaska, and our mission began. The first time I grasped the magnitude of this catastrophe was when I saw the Exxon Valdez, which had been moved from Blight Reef, where it ran aground, to an anchorage off Naked Island. This ship was longer than 3 football fields. 11 million gallons of crude oil had been dumped into this pristine bottle, a body of water. When you looked at Prince William Sound's shoreline, you thought, how can this environment ever recover? My team began its work moving through the sound on a launch, taking samples of water and fish. Early in our work in 1989, the crew aboard the Exxon Valdez noticed that schools of fish were swimming into a cargo space that had once held oil but had been ripped open. I was part of a team that boarded the ship to catch these fish and study them. One of the most important things we discovered was that our cleanup methods were not what we had hoped. We needed scientific research, and I took over a program to study how the shorelines recovered not just from oil exposure, but from how we remedied it. So, in effect, the Exxon Valdez determined the direction of my career for the next 20 years, studying how to respond better to spills in natural habitats. That research, not just by me, but by many others as well, changed the way first responders do their work. I have a collection of memorabilia from the Exxon Valdez, including glasses used during the christening with Exxon Valdez September 20th, 1986, etched into the glass, and a jar of crude oil gathered off an Alaskan beach. When I look back, it amazes me how much the Alaskan ecosystem recovered. If you went now and kayaked off the shores of Prince William Sound, you would never know this catastrophe had happened there. The resilience of the natural world continues to inspire me. This was by A.J. Baim, who frequently writes for the Wall Street Journal. He's the author of 7 books, most recently White Lies, The Double Life of Walter F. White and America's Darkest Secret. And now time for maybe one more tip on saving money, and this is in the section on gardening. Plant edible perennials. Many herbs and spices, among them garlic, rosemary, thyme, and oregano, will grow back year after year, making them a great value. Plus, they are often easy to grow because deer and other critters won't eat them. Several of these also do great in pots outside the kitchen door, so you don't even need a garden. Well, folks, it looks like we've run out of time again for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.